Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is birder, writer, Jeremy Minot. He is the former chief executive of Cambridge University Press and is a fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge. And we're talking about his book, Birdscapes, Birds in Our Imagination and Experience. Jeremy, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, good morning again. Thank you.
Well, and I want to mention that your newer book, Winged Words, Birds in the Ancient World, we've talked about, and that's so focused. I was wondering, there's a chapter in this book, Birdscapes, where you're sitting at the Delphi, and I was wondering if that book came out of that chapter.
Well, I think it did probably, yes. I was at Delphi in the middle of Greece, reflecting on ancient Greece and what the Greeks might have seen. And yes, you're right, that did give me the inspiration for the book on birds in the ancient world.
This book, Birdscapes, is brilliant in so many ways. You seem to approach the way we think about birds, not just birders, but people in general, and ask some very basic questions and then try to arrive at some answers. Talk to me about coming to that. I mean, it's such an interesting idea, what you did in this book.
Well, thank you. I'm afraid there are more questions than answers, but...
But at least you're asking them.
It seems to me there are a tremendous number of good books about how to watch birds, where to watch birds, field guides telling you what you're seeing and so on. But there are very few books that ask the question, why? And the question why interests me at least as much as what, where, when, and how. And I got interested in I've always been interested in a reflective way in why we watch birds, why we relate to them the way we do, why we perceive some things and not other things, why some people are driven to make lists of them, why they've become such symbols in our everyday lives and indeed in our political lives to some extent. Those are the sorts of questions that interest me. But I've been a lifelong birder since the age of about five, and you know, when you're doing bird watching, there's quite a bit of downtime and you're wandering along seawalls. And these are the sorts of questions I like to reflect on.
What I love about this book is every single chapter starts in a different location with you. And then it goes full circle at the end. And so there's sort of an international feel to this book, too, which I think is brilliant.
Well, thank you. It starts in the place where I am now, actually, Shingle Street. I'm looking out of my window onto the beach, and I've just had a long walk along the same seawall where I began that book. And as you say, that's the place where I end up. But in between, I visit New York, I go to Australia, I go to the Volga Delta, and these are all places that have been very meaningful for me and have given me wonderful experiences with birds that have given me great resources to think about.
What I'm surprised about reading your book is it's one of those experiences where, like, some of the questions seem so obvious, yet nobody's really asked them before. And one of them is, what are people's favorite birds and why? And that's a very simple question. People can immediately come up with a list, but then you bring it beyond that into asking, like, well, why is that your favorite bird? And one of the basic questions you ask is, are these charismatic species, or is it just a special experience you've had with that specific species in the past? I find that I answer it very differently as a birder than I would, I think, as a non-birder.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it's quite a nice exercise, isn't it, just to make a list of 5 or 10 birds that you would think of as your favorite birds without any analysis initially, just doing it from the gut, as it were.
Well, let me ask you, of your top five, just name one. What would be one of your favorites?
Well, I list various criteria that
I know
can attract one to birds, and the one that comes out top for me on most of them is the crane, actually.
I think the crane is an easy bird to really love. We finally have breeding sandhill cranes here in the Massachusetts.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, the last 10 years, they've started to breed here in very select locations. And people who've never seen cranes before, you may think that they're herons. They're not. And they move very differently. they have fascinating behavior. And every crane species I've ever seen has been a wonderful bird. So are we talking about aesthetics that create our favorite bird?
Well, that's one of the considerations, I think. I mean, beauty and aesthetics is certainly one thing. And I'm sure if, you know, the man or woman in the street, as it were, named their five favorite birds, some of them would just be beautiful birds. In America, I think of as the American warblers, for example.
Oh, yeah, they're easy to like. Nothing can beat a Blackburnian warbler in May.
I was just going to say that. I think of the warblers, the Blackburnian is my very favorite.
Oh my God, to see that with the sun rising, so you get that really emphasizes that fiery orange on the throat is just incredible.
That's wonderful. And I mean, in the UK, I think of birds like the kingfisher and
by the way, people who have never seen a European kingfisher, it makes our kingfisher look like black and white television.
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. It's certainly an extraordinary electric flash of blue.
Oh, my God.
You don't see it for more than a few seconds.
Yeah, you know, it's always gone. But, you know, you bring up there was a list of the favorite birds of Britain. People compiled that list. And what was fascinating is some of the birds that are on the list. And one of them was nightingale. Now, having birded Europe, I have both heard and eventually saw a nightingale. And it was very tough to see a nightingale. Talk to me. I mean, everybody's heard about nightingales. I mean, I think that's one of the most recognizable bird names in the Western world. But nightingale is a weird bird to have as a favorite bird.
Absolutely, because as you say, it's extremely hard to see, and when you do see it, it's not exactly fascinating physically, but the song is captivating, and it's entered deep into not only European culture, but world culture. I mean, as you say, everybody knows or think they know what a nightingale is, and it's purely on the basis of that extraordinary song.
By the way, it's not a spectacular bird to look at.
Not at all, no.
It's not like a Blackburnian warbler. It's a fairly dull bird.
It's a dull bird. It's got a bit of chestnut coloring if you catch it in the right light, but it's a fairly dull bird. And for example, is the skylark, which is, again, has got a wonderful song that everybody knows about because it's been celebrated in poetry. But it's, you know, it's a little brown job, basically.
or LBJ, as we say here in America, because it has a presidential reference. but, you know, one of the things you do in the book is you constantly reference so many things in this book. You reference the song a Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. Very famous song. Do you think a nightingale really did sing in Berkeley Square?
I think it was a robin disturbed by the streetlights.
And speaking of which, robin is and it's very different from our big chunko bird here. European robin is one of the most beloved birds in Britain, but it's a very odd bird.
Yes, I mean, it's loved without people really knowing much about it. It's got this familiar presence. It's got this nice bright red breast, which has given rise to all kinds of symbolisms. But if you knew more about robin behavior, you might be less attracted to them because they're extremely aggressive little birds. If you just put up a patch of red cloth, they'll attack it viciously. And but it is the national favorite, and it's just come into the news, actually. I don't know whether you had this news report in the U.S., but a European robin has just been spotted in the middle of Beijing in China.
I saw the pictures of like, hundreds of people lined up. It looks like a regular urban area.
The interesting thing about that for me is it just demonstrates that rarity is such a relative question.
And this is one of the questions. Let's dwell on that for a minute, because that's even within a small state like Massachusetts, what people consider rare is defined by geography. Something that's common on the coast, 40 miles inland, becomes a rarity.
Exactly. Geography and seasonality, I would suggest.
That's exactly right.
I mean, if you see a swallow in London or in New York in the middle of December, that's a rare bird.
Yeah, you got to document that one.
In New York, that's a rare bird.
That's right.
But a robin in Beijing now is an extraordinary bird. And it's the same, as you say, we can all think of seasons where a certain bird is rare or places where a certain bird is rare. So it's a really relative question, unless you're talking about absolute world rarities like, ivy-billed woodpecker
right,
or something.
Right, right. That bird may not be charismatic, as the word you discuss in the book. There's also another wonderful bird that you get a term from Gilbert White, who's I love Gilbert White's book, Amusive Birds. Explain that term.
Yes, well, he used it to mean fascinating birds, I think, and it's a rather quaint sort of 18th century term, which you don't hear much nowadays, but I rather liked it. He one of his favorite birds was a swift, and he often talks about swifts being amusive birds. Also, he was very keen on the hirundines, swallows and martins and so on, and I think he used it of those too. White's an interesting case because he was the spiritual father of all natural history
writing in
Britain, and with his wonderful diaries. But they're very detailed diaries of day-by-day observations of birds in the place he knew so well. And that's another kind of interest which is worth commenting on, I think, birds are not just attractive by being unusual. They can be attractive by being familiar. The places I know around here, I know them so well that every day I notice if something's gone, something's arrived, something's here in larger numbers. It's the close observation of a place you know well, which is extremely satisfying to me. And I think that's an important element in a lot of the attraction birds have to us. In a small way, people get to know the birds in their gardens, for example,
right,
and get to know their comings and goings. And that's very much a part of their attraction. We watch them and we think we understand their social behavior. We see them feeding, playing, communicating, fighting, mating, doing all the things for which there are human counterparts, as it were. And this is something that draws us to them.
That's one of the real joys of birding. This is a British term, but we've adopted it here in the States, is birding your local patch.
Yes, exactly.
Because you take an area, it can be a park, it can be any kind of combinations of, but it's close by and it's something, a place that you can check out frequently. And there's a feeling of, maybe mastery is too strong a word, but you really get to know that place, and you almost get to know
intimacy. Actually,
yeah, intimacy is a better word. And when you get to know the birds, it's almost like you're getting to know the individual birds. You look for that nest, that bird that nests in one bush for several years in a row, and you miss it when it's gone, and it doesn't return.
That's right.
And so it's one of those things that brings you closer with that feeling of that I'm understanding the natural world a little bit better on almost a deep emotional level.
I think that's absolutely right. You feel a kind of attachment and intimacy towards it.
You do.
It's one of the most satisfying things about bird watching, I think, to get to know your local patch really well. And of course, Gilbert White was our great example.
That was the best local patch.
American example.
The great thing about a local patch is your list of possible rarities is huge, because even if there's a forest 20 miles away that has one species, it may never show up in your local patch except once every 10 years, and you get excited about that, about seeing
exactly
that bird in your local patch.
Yeah. I get more excited about that sort of unusual bird.
Yeah, I do too.
Than I do about extreme rarities, if you know what I mean.
Well, extreme rarities have become such a... You were talking about the robin in China and the photographs in Beijing. The photographs I've seen of that... when I was younger, I used to enjoy those experiences where there's 200, 300 people in a big crowd all focused on one small bird. Now, I don't enjoy that as much at all.
No, that's the same true of me. I mean, an extreme rarity of that sort is a kind of vagrant that's become detached from its time and place. The example you gave of a bird that might live in a local forest 50 miles away, and, you know, it would be really interesting if it got into your local patch, is a much more interesting case, I think, because you become an observer of changes in the ranges of birds.
That's right.
And you become more sensitive to their seasonal movements. I mean, I've watched birds so long over in Britain that I've seen certain birds arrive, as it were, progressively from the Mediterranean following climate change. There's a bird called a little egret, very like your snowy egret, which was an extreme rarity in Britain, say, in the mid-20th century. That's when I first saw it. And you'd find a little egret then, and bird watchers would swarm from all over the country to look at it. Now, of course, you don't even raise your glasses to it, your binoculars to it. They're just everywhere. And there's another wave of them coming from the same direction. Things like purple herons, for example, driven by global warming from... or able to find habitats that now suit them in Britain. And I find that sort of movement very interesting too, and another way of getting to know birds and get it feeling you know what they're about.
Here in Massachusetts and New England, we've been going through the same thing. Within my lifetime, there was one wave of mockingbirds and titmice and cardinals way back in the 40s and the 50s, which came north. And then now in the 90s, we had mute swans, which are not native, red-bellied woodpeckers, and Carolina wrens. Now, when I started birding, I can remember staking out a red-bellied woodpecker that was coming to a feeder in the Connecticut River Valley. I waited all day to see that bird. That bird's now coming to my feeders as the Carolina wren.
Isn't that great? Yeah. What about the American robin? Is that becoming more of a resident?
Oh, that's always, I think there was always sort of a miss. What robins do is they change their feeding habits and they become itinerant frugivores in the wintertime. And here in Massachusetts, there can be some extraordinary winter robin roosts, usually in these plantings like arborvitae, where like 10,000 robins from all over
really?
Will come.
I didn't know that.
Oh yes, and so you don't see them on their lawn because we have snow on our lawn, and but they are around. But they're like itinerant. They're like the cedar waxwing, and they'll. I just had a flock of robins come to my backyard and disseminate my winterberry, and they're gone. They're off to find another thing. One of the
charismatic bird for you, waxwing.
I love how anybody who's gotten a close look at a waxwing. I defy you not to really enjoy that bird.
Yeah,
it's the colors on it are magical. Now,
do you get bohemian as well?
We get them as eruptives, and we had an incredible eruption about 10 years ago where there were just big flocks of them, and they sometimes single birds will sometimes show up in flocks of cedar waxwings. But years ago, we had big flocks, like over 100 of Bohemian waxwings come down. That was fascinating. There's a story in your book of you in Central Park. I love this story. And then talking about what you consider a rarity. And you're really enjoying spring migration. You're seeing a lot of warblers, lots of thrushes and stuff like that. Somebody reports a weird duck at the reservoir to the north.
Yeah.
And, you really want to see a prothonotary warbler. To you, that would be the big thing. And what was the duck?
It was a tufted duck, and because I'd been talking to some of the birders, they'd recognized my English accent. And someone had the feeling that it might be a European bird, so they said, "Hi, Jeremy, you just come and have a look at this duck up at the reservoir." And it was a damn tufted duck.
Well, and explain why, Dan, tufted ducks are not a species that breeds in North America, and although they're starting to show up a little bit more regularly than they do before. Like here in Massachusetts, there's at least one or two yearly. But in Europe, if you bird around, you see, I remember I have photographs of like ponds filled with a lot of tufted ducks.
Well, Mark, I saw 20 tufted ducks this morning. And they're just on a lagoon a little way up the coast from here. But,
It was a great bird. It was a great bird in Central Park, but that shows you about what we consider rare. What really sort of gets us going is all very personal and very relative.
Very much so. Yeah.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, always a pleasure to talk to him, is Jeremy Minot. He is the former chief executive of Cambridge University Press, a fellow of Wolfson College, Cambridge. But we're talking about his new book, Birdscapes, Birds in Our Imagination and Experience. I should say that's the book that came out before your newest book, Winged Words. Jeremy, there's one of the reasons we find some birds appealing has to do with our experience with them. And there's a story in the book about you and Leach's storm petrels, which was just a beautiful piece of writing. At the surface, anybody who's not a birder looking at a Leach's storm petrel is going to say it's not a very charismatic bird. But you had a wonderful experience with that bird.
Well, that's right. It's a dull bird to look at. It's a sooty brown color. It's very hard to see because they're mainly nocturnal. It's a pelagic species that feeds out in the deep ocean. And there are just three or four stations off Britain, off the far northwest, where there are rocky islands where the Leach's petrel breeds. And I was determined to get to them because I'd heard tapes of Leach's petrel calling, and it's the weirdest sound. Someone described it as like goblins on acid. It's a kind of wailing, witch-like noise. Anyway, so I chartered a boat with a couple of friends, and I was taken to this island, which is an uninhabited island, and I spent the night there in a small tent on my own. And it was tremendously satisfying in itself, in that while I was sitting in my tent waiting for it to get dark enough for the Leach's petrels, I hoped to appear. There was a lot else going on. There was some migration going on. A cuckoo came through calling, which seemed extraordinary.
That seems weird.
In a rocky island 40 miles off the coast of Scotland. There were plovers coming, I remember. I think I heard a heron. So there was quite a lot going on in the evening. And anyway, at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd been forcing myself to stay awake. My dread was that I would fall asleep and miss
the whole show.
But I kept myself going, and it was a very unpleasant early morning because it was raining, and by then it was, you know, pretty dark, of course. And I then suddenly heard this extraordinary noise, a sort of chuckling noise outside the tent. And I went out, and wow, I got the full chorus. They were coming in off the sky like moths arriving and sort of plummeting down around my feet. It was a wonderful experience. These were the returning birds going back to their nests. And the weird noises I talked about were a kind of signaling device between the bird in the nesting hole and the incoming bird. It was a kind of communication. But I recommend that you listen to a tape of one. It's just remarkable.
We actually have leeches here, and they a small, very small population breed on a couple of tiny islands, much smaller population than you experienced off the
south.
No, I haven't. And the ones that nest here, though, nest in stone walls. And the way that the people who monitor them find the nest to monitor it is that they smell the nest. They can smell the real musky odor of the nest, and then they can pull them off. Now, I've seen them flying around. If you go way offshore, you'll get numbers of Leach's storm petrels flying around, not in night, but during the day.
Really?
Yeah, and so I've seen lots of Leach's storm petrels. And also, weirdly, when there's a hurricane, of the storm petrels that we have here, that's the one that gets blown inland. So I've actually had Leach's storm petrels on ponds and reservoirs here in central Massachusetts.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but they don't. They're not faring well. They're usually in a stressed condition, and so I'm not sure. And I always feel bad when I see a bird like that. You know, yeah, great. I'm able to tick Leach's storm petrel on my Worcester County list, but unfortunately, the bird is very, very stressed.
Yeah.
Now, when you're talking,
petrels are an interesting case, aren't they? Because I mean, there's another bird you'll know about, the Wilson's petrel.
Oh, that's the common one. You can actually see that from the shore here in the summer, looking out. That's the one. That's the go-to petrel that you're going to see here.
Right. Well, of course, they do occur in some British seas, just off the Isles of Scilly, for example, where I tend to go in October. You can get a boat, a pelagic trip out, and you'll possibly see one or two Wilson's petrels. But that's another interesting thing because, you know, there are about, I think there are about 50 million of them in the world. They're one of the world's commonest birds. And yet they're the devil to see from Britain.
Well, it's like once you go into the realm of pelagic birds, you're going into a very different realm from birds that we see on the land because there's an awful lot of space where there's no birds. And they can go, and they breed sometimes on tiny islands like in the South Atlantic in Tristan da Cunha or something like that.
Oh, so they do, yeah.
And I'm always fascinated. I was on a tiny island off the coast of Australia, Lord Howe, and I had an experience with short-tailed shearwaters coming in at night and calling and then landing on the ground at your feet and then going into burrows. At that point, they would moan. They would sound like ghosts. And the entire island was like alive with the sound of these moaning shearwaters, which was amazing. You know, you were talking about, and that experience, by having that kind of experience with Bleach's storm petrel, that's got to make that one of your top 10 favorite birds.
Absolutely, just for that reason, yeah.
So, and
it's partly a question there of location.
And for me, it's like a
location.
Yeah, for me, it's Virginia Rail. I'm really passionate about Virginia Rails. I love the fact that you have to get up at dawn. You're up in a marsh. You hardly ever get a look at them. And when you do, they have like a lot of attitude. They're quite aggressive and stuff like that. And they'll actually chase other rails that call. But, you know, our experience with birds really changes what we think is special about birds.
That's right. It's a good example of how the occasion is the interesting thing that imparts importance rather than the physical characteristics of the bird itself.
Believe it or not, Jeremy, we're out of time.
Oh.
But yeah, part of the problem with when I start talking to you, it's like two old guys talking about birds. It's going to go. It's going to go.
Well, I'm an old guy, that's for sure.
I am too, for sure. So that's like this book. This is one of my favorite bird books that I've read in many years because it gets to that. It gets me to think about what I'm doing. My guest tonight is birder and writer Jeremy Minot. He's been the former chief executive at Cambridge University Press, a fellow at Wilson College, Cambridge. And we're talking about a book that he wrote a couple of years ago, but it is really still holds up. Birdscapes, Birds in Our Imagination and Experience. And it's a wonderful book. Jeremy, we're going to have to talk again. We basically talked about one chapter. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to talk with you, Mark.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.